ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। So reading today from verses 37 to 39 of the 10th canto, chapter number 8, chapter entitled Lord Krishna Shows the Universal Form. We'll read text number 37 together. Sa tatra dadrishe vishvam जगत्स्तास्नो चकं दिशः साद्रिद्विपाब्दिभूगोलम् स वाग्निन्दुतरकम् सातपुतिश्चक्रं जलं तेजो नाभस्वान् वियदेव च वैकारिकानिन्द्रियाणि मनोमात्रा गुणस्त्रयः एतद्विचित्रं सहजीवकाल स्वभावकर्मसयलिङ्गभेदं सुनोस्तनौ वीक्ष्य विदारितस्ये Rajam Sahatmanam Avapa Shankam. What word translation? Sa, Mother. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Translation. When Krishna opened his mouth wide by the order of Mother Yashoda, she saw within his mouth all moving and non-moving entities, outer space and all directions, along with mountains, islands, oceans, the surface of the earth, the blowing wind, fire, the moon and the stars. She saw the planetary systems, water, light, air, sky and creation by transformation of ahankar. She also saw the senses, the mind, sense perception and the three qualities, goodness, passion and ignorance. She saw the time allotted for the living entities. She saw natural instinct and the reactions of karma. And she saw desires and different varieties of bodies, moving and non-moving. Seeing all these aspects of the cosmic manifestation along with herself and Vrindavan Dham, she became doubtful and fearful of her son's nature. Purport. All the cosmic manifestations that exist on the gross and subtle elements, as well as the means of the agitation, the three gunas, the living entity, creation, maintenance, annihilation, and everything going on in the external energy of the Lord, all this comes from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Govinda. Everything is within the control of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is also confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 9.10, Maya Dekshena Prakriti Suyatesa Characharam. Everything in the material nature, Prakriti, works under his direct control. Because all these manifestations come from Govinda, they could all be visible within the mouth of Govinda. Quite astonishingly, Mother Yashoda was afraid because of intense maternal affection. She could not believe that within the mouth of her son, such things could appear. Yet she saw them, and therefore she was struck with wonder. She was struck with fear and wonder. Hare Krishna. Seeking the blessings of all the devotees to be able to say something on this text and purport by Srila Prabhupada. So we see over here that Lord Krishna, in his form as a small child, has now opened his mouth wide just to reciprocate with the love of his mother. And his mother sees so many different things, moving and non-moving within the mouth of baby Krishna. And after seeing all this, Mother Yashoda becomes fearful. And we have been seeing over the last so many days, so many different pastimes of Lord Krishna as a small child. And each and every one of them create a sense of fear in the Lord, in the mind of Mother Yashoda and Nanda Maharaj, particularly Mother Yashoda. And Srila Prabhupada was giving a class in Vrindavan on the Nectar of Devotion, series of lectures. And Srila Prabhupada was explaining that this particular emotion of fear, which is actually subordinate to love, can be so powerful, particularly when the person in relation to that fear is the one that you love. Which means that if there is a person whom you love so much, much more than your own life, then anything in relation to that person actually evokes fear in your heart. Like we see, just in the previous pastime of Trinavarta, demon taking away Lord Krishna. So Mother Yashoda had baby Krishna on her lap and she was actually feeding him. And all of a sudden she found that baby Krishna was becoming heavier and heavier. And then, getting bewildered and again getting fearful, she just kept baby Krishna down on the ground. And then she invoked the blessings of Lord Narayan upon baby Krishna. And then she went about to do her duties. And then when Trinavarta came, and of course Lord Krishna wanted to experience a wonderful ride up in the sky, so he became extremely light so that Trinavarta could carry him up. And there was such a fierce dust storm that was created that nobody was able to see anything. And then Yashoda, for a short time, she was completely blinded by the dust that was created. And then when she saw the place where baby Krishna had been kept, she saw that baby Krishna was not there. And then she started wailing so piteously, just like how a cow had lost its calf. And similarly, when Lord Krishna goes into the coils of the Kaliya serpent, also we see how Nanda Maharaj and Mother Yashoda, they come on the banks of the river Yamuna, and then they find that Lord Krishna, baby Krishna, is there in the coils of Kaliya. And they are so much in this agony of fear for baby Krishna's well-being. Such an overpowering emotion of fear in their heart. Just like last Sunday, Braj Bihari Prabhu was explaining that Mother Yashoda's love for baby Krishna was so intense that, when Krishna would go out into the pasturing grounds, she would not be able to bear to see Krishna going away along with his cowherd friends. And then as Krishna would be going, she would follow Krishna, and then she would, after Krishna had gone for some distance, she would call out to Krishna, and then she would make Krishna come to her, and then she would adjust Krishna's clothes, and then she would bid again Krishna goodbye. And then after some time, after he had gone some more distance, again she would call him back, and then she would give him a little bit of prasad. And again after he had left, again she would call him back and give him some pan to chew. So every moment that Mother Yashoda would be thinking that Lord Krishna is going to be going away from her, she would be feeling so much of intense separation. And that separation was coming out basically because she was so fearful that, nothing should happen to Krishna. And that fear was coming out of her intense love. And we see that this particular thing, which is also there in human beings, I remember several years back, in fact, more than 30 years back, when we were staying in a place which was different from Bombay, we would come to Bombay in the summer vacations, and I would be staying in the house of my mother's sister, who was staying in Chembur. And my mother's sister was already married at that time for more than 20, 25 years. But then every time her husband would leave to the office in the morning, she would be there at the door to bid him goodbye. And not only that, you know, just outside the building, he would come onto the main road, and then from the main road, he would take a small turn in order to go into the highway. And just at one particular spot, I distinctly remember, at one particular spot, you know, which is the last place from where his wife would be able to see him, he would turn back and then wave his hand like this. And then my auntie, she would be so shy, you know, she would just wave her hand like this. She would not even raise her hand on top. And they already married for 25 years. And I used to wonder, you know, what is this, you know? This very special exchange of love taking place between... And those are the days when we didn't have telephones and, you know, oh, forget it, what to talk about, mobiles. I mean, Bombay also, telephones were pretty rare. So, and I used to wonder, why is it that, you know, and then throughout the day, my auntie would be, you know, sort of meditating when her husband would be coming back. And he would leave, and in, you know, he would leave at exactly the same time, because he would catch exactly the same train from Chembur to VT station, because he worked in the same office for 59 years. Can you believe it? He joined a company at the age of 16, and then at the age of 75, at the age of 60, he should have retired, but they didn't allow him to retire. So they made him continue, and then he was working till the age of 74 or 75. You know, he was working in that company, and finally he became, you know, quite old, and then he couldn't go to his office. So for nearly 58, 59 years he was working, and every day he would catch the same train, Monday to Friday, and he would catch the same train back. So my auntie knew exactly what time he would come back. You know, it'll be 10 minutes past 8. He has to be in the house. You know, that was something that he had followed for the last 25 years. And if for any reason he was late, she would be in so much anxiety. You know, what happened to my husband? And there was no way by which she could call him. And, you know, the nearest telephone was maybe half a kilometer away. And even if, you know, something were to happen to him, you know, how would she ever get to know? Because, you know, the person who, you know, in case he makes an accident, then they have to call up this telephone number, and the person has, you know, in that house has to respond. Nowadays with mobile, it's so easy, you know, you have it in the pocket, it's ringing all the time. But in those days, it was so difficult. So for nearly, I remember, 40 years, till they got a telephone in their house, this exchange between them would take place, you know. And then much later, one day, I just happened to be talking to her, and then I asked her, you know, what is it? Why was this particular, you know, small wave, why was this happening every day, you know? So she told me that actually, every day my husband would leave, I would feel that maybe he would never come back home. You know, because Bombay is such a place. You leave home and then you are never sure whether you're going to come back home or return back home. So, and she said that for the 12 hours that, you know, I would be in separation from him, that particular wave was what actually kept me going on throughout the day. You know. So such an intense emotion, you know, this love invokes in a person's heart, you know. And it is manifest even in human beings. So what to talk about the relationship between Mother Yashoda and the Supreme Personality of Godhead? To what extent, you know? So what Raj Bihari Prabhu was telling us on Sunday in the class was absolutely something that we could all relate to. You know, Mother Yashoda did not want to lose sight of Lord Krishna even for a single second. You know, it was so painful to her heart that he would be going. And then similarly, when Krishna would come back home, then the cowherd boys would feel so much separation in their heart till the next day morning. And then the moment they would get up, they would brush their teeth, and then they would have bath, and then come straight to the house of Mother Yashoda so that they could once again associate with Krishna. So this was the intense mood of separation in both places, you know, morning to evening by Mother Yashoda, and then from evening to next day morning by the cowherd boys. So this predominance of fear, which is actually very positive, it's a very positive emotion. Now the emotion, fear is, it's not a negative emotion, but it's a very positive emotion. So exactly the opposite of this is this negative emotion of fear, which we see more in this material world. You know, like the fear of dying, the fear of death is so strong in the hearts of every person, because death is the final thing that is going to take away everything from you. And what to talk about now, millions and millions of years back, Hiranyakashipu, you know, we are going to be celebrating Narsingha Chaturdashi in just a few days from now, a couple of days. So, we could just spend some time on this particular episode to highlight how it is that a person who actually was very well learned, he was extremely well learned in the scriptures, to such an extent when Hiranyaksha had been killed by Lord Varahadeva, and all the family members were mourning the death of their husband, Vrishabhanu, that's a wife of Hiranyaksha, was mourning, and then the children, they were all, you know, in tremendous separation. Hiranyakashipu actually comes and starts preaching to this family and telling them that, you know, actually this body is temporary, you know, everybody has to die sooner or later. And then he gives so many different examples. He gives the example of this king by the name Suyagya and says that this particular king was lying on the battlefield dead, and then his wives were not willing to let go of the body, and the time that was prescribed for the body to be cremated was passing. And you know, there was this wives were just not allowing the body to be taken away. And to such an extent that Yamaraj had to actually come in the form of a small child. And you know, Yamaraj had to tell such deep philosophy. You know, Yamaraj started saying that, you know, actually, I don't know why you all are crying like this. You know, actually the person whom you think is your husband is actually lying over here. So why are you crying? He's not gone anywhere. And so many other things, you know, Yamaraj started saying to the wives of Suyagya, and finally they understood that they should actually be cremating the body of the king. So all this was being told by Hiranyakashipu to the relatives of Hiranyaksha. But then, immediately after that, he goes into this mood of austerities, performing austerities in order to become immortal. So on the one hand, he's telling all the relatives that, you know, this body is temporary, it is going to die in any case, and, you know, we all, you know, just like people who are staying in a hotel, we come together in the morning, I mean, and then evening we are separated. Yeah, or just like, you know, twigs which come together when they are going on a river, and then, you know, after some time they are separated. I mean, this is very deep philosophy which we all use for our various preaching, you know, as part of our preaching tools. And Hiranyakashipu is telling all this, so basically he understood that, you know, this human form of life is temporary, and you have to die some point of time or the other. But then when it comes to his own personal life, he is trying his level best to become immortal. And then to what extent he does his austerities in order to become immortal. So this is the fallacy that when, you know, we try to preach to others, we want to give them the philosophy, you know, as would be applicable to them, but then we don't want to apply that philosophy to our own lives. So it's a very typical example. And similarly, the greater, another fear is the fear of losing our prestige or losing our position in society or position in the eyes of people. You know, I remember recently this Krishna Chandra Prabhu was telling me that you know, in the outside world, in the upper echelons of society, there is such a deep competition, you know, just to be one on top of another, you know. So there is, like, you know, most of us would not even have traveled by a aeroplane, you know. A lot of people in India wouldn't have traveled by an aeroplane. But among the upper echelons of society, to travel by an aeroplane, you know, is considered to be absolutely, you know, third class. I mean, to travel by a commercial aeroplane, they would like to travel by their own aeroplane. You know, everybody would like to own their own aeroplanes. And when a person who reaches that particular stature, if he doesn't travel by, or if for some time he owns an aeroplane, the aeroplane is taken away from him, it's in so much intense separation, you know, there is so much of frustration and depression. He goes into actually depression, you know, when he's got the facilities to travel by a normal commercial airplane, but you know, because he was at one time owning his own plane and then now he has moved down in the scale, he's just not able to show his face. There is, you know, so much of feeling of separation when particularly something like that is taken away. So that's because the false ego gets so strongly affected. You know, all of us have that to a certain degree or the other. But then in the world outside, false ego is what actually drives people to compete with each other, to somehow or the other try to get something that is better than what the other person has. And people push themselves to such an extent that they spend their whole life trying to achieve something. You know, it's actually a phantasmagoria, you know, that the whole illusory world in trying to achieve something that you don't have just because somebody else has it. And this is the fear that is there so deep in the hearts of a materialistic person. Why is it that I am not possessing that what somebody else is possessing? So much of envy, and consequent to that, there is so much of, you know, feeling of inadequacy and depression. Why is it that I can't possess something that he has? And this fear it drives him to work harder and harder and harder, and finally at the end, you know, the whole thing is so futile. But when a devotee sees that actually a person is struggling so hard in trying to fulfill whatever, you know, his inner desires, you know, to get more wealth or to get more prestige or to get more fame, a devotee is actually very compassionate. A devotee feels very much pitiful. He feels, you know, why is it that this person is striving so hard? What is the whole point? And he feels a deep sense of compassion to that person, you know. So in the materialistic society, everybody is envying each other. But when a devotee sees how a person who is chasing all this material desires of his, a devotee actually pities such a person. Because a devotee realizes that to whatever extent he may try to fulfill these desires, these desires can never be fulfilled. Because desires come upon us like the ocean. There is no limit to the extent to which one could go to fulfill one's own desires. So that's the law of nature. And that's how this whole world is made. A devotee understands that. But a non-devotee, you know, gets caught up in this whole illusion of trying to, you know, get more and more and more. And he becomes so frustrated. And we see even in spiritual circles how it is that, you know, a person is not in proper control of their senses. They get so much agitated when they see that somebody has not behaved in the way in which they would like them to behave. And a very typical example is Durvasa Muni. Now, actually, Durvasa Muni was a great sage, you know, who had access right up to Vaikuntha Loka. And on the self same body, you could actually go to Vaikuntha Loka. So from that point of view, we can understand that he was a person who had, you know, a tremendous amount of spiritual credit. But then when he saw that Ambarish Maharaj, you know, had done a small, I mean, apparently small mistake, which actually was not a mistake, because he had taken the advice of the sages, and the sages had told him that it was perfectly all right to be drinking some water. But because he felt, Durvasa Muni felt that his own false ego was affected, you know, immediately he brought out this terrible demon to kill Ambarish Maharaj. So that somehow or the other, I have to try and protect my false ego. And similarly, we see also Lord Indra, when he was seeing that how Prithu Maharaj was performing his Ashwamedha Yajnas, And then, you know, from 1 to 2 to 3 to 99 Ashwamedha Yajnas, and Indra, who was the performer of 100 Ashwamedha Yajnas, when he saw that his title to this 100 Ashwamedha Yajnas was being threatened, he immediately becomes so fearful. And then somehow or the other, he wants to see to it that Maharaj Prithu does not perform this 100th Ashwamedha Yajna. And there was, and we all know the story, how he takes on so many different roles in order to come and, you know, take charge of this horse. And finally, Lord Brahma had to intervene and come and tell Prithu Maharaj that, you know, it's okay. There's no need for you to perform this 100th Ashwamedha Yajna. It's better that Lord Indra, let him hold this title of performer of this 100 Ashwamedha Yajnas. You know. So this is this, you know, just that fear that my power and my prestige would be affected. Actually, Indra is also a devotee of the Lord. And Indra has had so many different experiences in the past where his false ego had been crushed. But yet, time and again, you know, for our own knowledge, you know, he time and again performs his pastimes in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Just so for us to understand that even though we might be holding such a, you know, position of being the king of the heaven, still we can be vulnerable to all these attacks of false ego if you're not careful. But on the other hand, we see from the pages of the Srimad Bhagavatam how devotees of the Lord are completely fearless. So many different examples, you know, and one particular example that comes to my mind is that of Vritrasura. Now, Vritrasura was not an ordinary demon. He was actually Maharaj Chitraketu in his previous life, and he had been cursed by Mother Parvati to become a demon like Vritrasura, and a very, very fearsome demon. And Vritrasura was, because he was a pure devotee of the Lord, he had the knowledge that actually he was going to be killed by Indra. And he also knew that the weapon that Indra possessed, the thunderbolt, was actually created out of the bones of Dadichi. And it is very interesting how in this fight between Vritrasura and Indra, Vritrasura is the one who is actually telling Indra that, you know, kill me. Why are you hesitating to kill me? I am going to die. I know I am going to die. And this particular weapon that you have, which has been empowered by Lord Vishnu, that is a weapon that is going to be used to kill me. I know that. And here, Vritrasura makes a very powerful statement. He says, no one except the Supreme Lord is guaranteed to be always victorious. No one except the Supreme Lord is guaranteed to be always victorious. And sometimes we see that even when we come into Krishna consciousness and we want to, you know, we want to do so many services for Srila Prabhupada and the movement and Lord Krishna, at times we get carried away into thinking that whatever we are doing, we are always going to be emerging victorious. So even devotees of the Lord sometimes, quite often, they encounter situations where actually, for their own purification, Krishna puts them in such a situation that they are completely smashed. And this is actually good for us. This is good for our own advancement in our Krishna consciousness. That at times, although we might be doing our service, we find that people are not appreciating our service. People are thinking that we are actually hampering their performance or their own service to Lord Krishna. We are coming in the way of their service. And sometimes over a period of time, we actually start thinking that, you know, we are the controllers. Even within the realm of Krishna consciousness, we think that we are the controllers. And this is so dangerous for our Krishna consciousness. The moment we come to that stage where we think that we are the controllers and we are trying to perform our responsibilities, trying to put others down. So that is the time when we are actually in the most dangerous situation. So here is Vritrasura telling Indra that finally I'm going to die. It's only a matter of time. So why don't you kill me? Actually, Srila Prabhupada writes in the purport that the mood of a devotee is that he wants to somehow or the other, in the service of the Lord, give up his life. Whereas Indra, who was actually wanting to kill Dhritarashtra just in order to facilitate his own sense gratification, is actually going to be continuing on in this material world. But a devotee doesn't care. He doesn't care whether he's alive or dead, so far as he is performing his duties and responsibilities in Krishna consciousness. Similarly, we see also in the pastime of Srila Prabhupada, how fearless he was when he was getting this land in Juhu. Now, if you read this particular pastime in the Lilamrit, it's so amazing. Now, Srila Prabhupada had seen this piece of land, I mean 4.5 acres of land, which Srila Prabhupada at that time paid about 14 or 15 lakhs of rupees, which I was just discussing a couple of weeks back with a member from the ISKCON Bureau. They had recently valued this land at around 200 crores. What Srila Prabhupada in 1970 had paid 14 lakhs, today is worth, at a very conservative estimate, around 200 crores of rupees. So I don't know how many times appreciation that is. More than 1,000 times appreciation, right? But Srila Prabhupada had the vision at that time that, you know, this land I should acquire. I mean, he could have been content with this apartment that they had in Akash Ganga and right in the heart of the city. And all his disciples, they were actually saying that this is the place where we should be living. And Juhu is such a far off place. And in 1970, Juhu was actually beyond the outer limit of Bombay. The outer limit of Bombay at that time was Dadar. You know, anything beyond Dadar was not considered to be Bombay at all. Like now we consider anything beyond Virar is not part of Bombay. Anything beyond Dadar was not considered to be Bombay. It was some other world. And there Srila Prabhupada, who actually had seen this piece of land as he was taking a morning walk through that particular place, and he had liked that piece of land, Srila Prabhupada was completely determined to get that land for Krishna. And then when he comes across this Mr. N, who was determined right from day one to cheat Srila Prabhupada, he had already cheated a company earlier from this piece of land. And he had come to Srila Prabhupada only with the motive of cheating him. And this particular person was a very prominent personality. He was not just like you and me, you know, some ordinary people staying here in Bombay. A very, very prominent personality. Now, with tremendous political contacts and tremendous contacts with the police. And Srila Prabhupada had no clue that this person was of such a background. But anyway, Srila Prabhupada entered into this agreement to purchase this land. And then he entrusted this to the care of the devotees. And then he told the devotees to go on to the land. And the devotees, you know, they started staying on the land. Then after some time, the devotees were finding that this condition, or this the living conditions on the Juhu land was so pathetic. You know, mosquitoes and rats and cockroaches and snakes. That they wrote to Srila Prabhupada saying that, Srila Prabhupada, it's very difficult for us to continue over here. We would like to go back to our apartment in Akash Ganga. And at that time, Srila Prabhupada made this very, very historic statement to them. Wouldn't you like to get purified? So the spiritual master understands what is necessary for us to get purified in our own advancement in our Krishna consciousness. At times we are pretty much laid back and coasting along in the beautiful river of Krishna consciousness, thinking that, you know, we can just go along with the tide. Right? There are so many others who are practicing Krishna consciousness, so we can just tag along with them and be along with them, and we will also make our advancement in Krishna consciousness. Right? But at times the spiritual master sees that this person requires some extra special mercy, extra purification, in order for him to make some further advancement in his own Krishna consciousness. And the spiritual master knows, and he gives service to you according to that particular assessment that he has made of you. And then we see how devotees, you know, when they are entrusted with responsibilities by Srila Prabhupada, you know, over the years, at the time when Srila Prabhupada was here on the planet, how much they blossomed in their own Krishna consciousness. Like when Srila Prabhupada wanted to construct this Krishna Balaram guest house and Krishna Balaram temple in Vrindavan, there was actually nobody to be doing this construction. So he approached Gurudas and Yamuna and told them that, please, I request you to go to Vrindavan and start the construction of the Krishna Balaram temple. And Srila Prabhupada tells them that, I know that you are not qualified for this purpose. You don't have any construction experience. But you just be sincere. And if you are sincere, Krishna will reward you with all the facilities in order to do this service for him. And Gurudas and Yamuna take up this challenge, and you know, we all know this from the pages of the Lilamrit, how it is that, you know, just, you know, in Bombay, it is difficult for a foreigner to survive. And what to talk about in Vrindavan, you know, they would be cheated by the local people, actually daylight robbery, something that would cost 10 rupees, they would charge 100 rupees, and you know, these people wouldn't even know. And at every stage, Srila Prabhupada had to be guiding them and telling them that this is what you are supposed to do. And so many delays in the construction of the Krishna Balaram temple, and Srila Prabhupada was so patient, you know. So here in Bombay, the devotees were getting so much harassed by all this external factors over there. And then they told Srila Prabhupada that, you know, we don't want to continue on this land. But Srila Prabhupada told them, please, I want you to stay over there. And I have kept these deities, Radha Ras Bihari. And I promised them that I shall build a beautiful temple for them. So Mr. N was trying his level best to somehow or the other evict the devotees out from there. And then Srila Prabhupada, so the devotees were really getting frustrated, and then they were thinking that, you know, this N is such a powerful person that he could actually harm us, that if we continue to leave over here. And then they wrote to Srila Prabhupada saying that, you know, there's no point in us continuing over here. We would like to terminate the sales agreement that we have already signed with this Mr. N. And Srila Prabhupada at the time was actually in Ahmedabad. And, you know, he was conducting a Pandal program over there. And Srila Prabhupada wrote back to them saying that under no circumstance should you cancel this sales agreement. But the devotees were getting so much overwhelmed by whatever was going on over there that they all got together and decided that the best course of action would be to cancel this sales agreement. And then they did that, and then they phoned up Srila Prabhupada, and then Srila Prabhupada said, now everything is finished. Whatever I had set out to do, there is nothing more that can be done. But still Srila Prabhupada did not give up hope. And then he entered into a new sales agreement, and he sent some more devotees to Bombay. And then Srila Prabhupada personally came to Hyderabad, where he was having a preaching program. And then here he called Mr. N to come to Hyderabad. And in fact, Mr. N happened to be in Hyderabad at that time. And then they met, and then they drafted a new sales agreement. A very beautiful pastime, you know, how Srila Prabhupada interacts with N, who had come with his guru, you know. So, and even after the new sales agreement was executed, or rather immediately after the new sales agreement was executed, then still Mr. N was not cooperating. And then Srila Prabhupada had to come to Bombay, and there was such a vicious argument between Srila Prabhupada. I mean, here is a great saint, you know, what business does he have fighting with this demon? And Srila Prabhupada engaged in such a debate with him, and you know, this person said that, you people are from the CIA, and you know, I don't want you on my property, and you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and you people are thinking that this land belongs to you, you're the owner of this land. And immediately Srila Prabhupada stopped him and said, we are not the owners of land, Lord Krishna is the owner of the land. So powerful Srila Prabhupada's immediate response, that we are not the owners of the land, Lord Krishna is the owner of the land. And then within 2 weeks after that, Mr. N departed from this mortal world. We don't know where he went, but he went from here. And everybody thought that now, you know, things would happen in a proper way in the Juhu land. But it was not to be. Mrs. N continued the fight. And then, you know, we all know how these bulldozers came and this demolition squad and this political personality, you know, how he helps Srila Prabhupada. There's so much of Agyata Sukriti, you know, that he performed just by this one telephone call that he made to this municipal commissioner telling him to stop the demolition. Right? We don't want to name him. But, you know, actually it was my realization that all the success that this person subsequently received was only because of that small service that he did to Radharas Bihari. Tremendous service. Just one telephone call was adequate for the whole demolition to be stopped. Right? And then after that, there was a huge publicity that was created by Srila Prabhupada. He himself was driving everything. He said, go on and tell the newspapers, tell all the media people that this is what Mrs. N is actually doing. You know? So the whole plan backfires on Mrs. N and her, and then she comes and falls at the feet of Srila Prabhupada and starts crying and she surrenders. Now, which person would ever have so much guts to fight such a strong personality like Mr. N? You know, here is a 75-year-old man. I mean, from a physical point of view, he had absolutely no resources. He had a bunch of disciples who were not even knowing what they were doing, right? Who had no intentions or who had no desire to stay in that particular place. They actually wanted to let go and give it back to Mr. N so that they could get a chance to come back and stay in this Akash Ganga apartment. But, and Srila Prabhupada, you know, single-handedly was pushing. There was nobody else who was actually supporting Srila Prabhupada. He was single-handedly pushing to get this Juhu land. Absolutely fearless. So when we are finally, when we are doing something for Lord Krishna empowers us. You know, although we might be on our own insignificant, we may not be capable of doing anything, but we are having the conviction that we are doing this as a service to Krishna. Satsarup Maharaj writes in the Lilamrit that Srila Prabhupada had this conviction that he was doing this for Radha Ras Bihari. He had given this promise to Radha Ras Bihari that he'll build a beautiful temple for them in Juhu. And he wanted to fulfill that promise. And secondly, he knew that Bombay was a gateway to India. It was the most prominent city in the whole country of India. And to have a temple here in Bombay meant that ISKCON and Krishna consciousness would flourish within India. So, Srila Prabhupada was completely focused and convinced. And Lord Krishna reciprocated with him. And then today, what we can see, this beautiful temple that has come up over there in Juhu. So, we'll end now. It's already 9:20. We want, are there any questions? Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki. Jai.